Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media Panel, Accelerating Development in IoT and Embedded, New Age Smart Development Portfolio for a New Embedded Era. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's panelists Mark Wright from Ayla Networks, Walt Bowers from Eurotech, Brian Kelly from Golgi, Stan Schneider from RTI, and Michael Wunderlich from ThingWorks. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of panel discussion, leaving 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, let's run down some important features of your viewing console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate in today's event. You can simply submit your question by typing the question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the presentation. We encourage you to do so early and often. While you're looking at the question, the material's fresh in your mind. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the eCast. We have an all-star panel of IoT experts today. Mark Wright is a Director of Partnerships and Evangelization at Ayla Networks. He has a long and successful track record in military, industrial, and consumer markets prior to entering the IoT space. His background in high-reliability industries and familiarity with products and technologies like embedded internet and Wi-Fi make him a valuable asset in the IoT space. Walt Bowers is a technical solutions architect at Eurotech. Walt's background is software engineering with a strong background in Java. He's been involved in IoT gateways and edge analytics while also participating in open source IoT projects, so he brings a strong development solutions theme to the panel. Brian Kelly, the CTO of Golgi, where he steers their mobile and cloud service to address challenges involving the network connectivity and end-to-end application development across mobile apps, devices, and servers. He has over 30 years of industry experience, very strong development history and background in scaling data and transport solutions for IoT. Stan Schneider is a CEO at Real Time Innovations, the industrial Internet of Things connectivity platform company. He has in-depth knowledge of IoT technology, transports, and applications, and serves on the advisory board for Smart Industry and IoT Solutions World Congress. Michael Wunderlich is the IoT principal technical sales engineer at ThingWorks. He has 13 years of experience in the IoT space and has real-world experience with helping large companies get to market with their IoT applications. Welcome, panelists, and let's get right to our IoT platform development paradigm topics. So let's talk about the paradigm for a minute. IoT is really a mashup of systems and functions between sensors, devices, gateway, and cloud. So when you look at these platforms, each architectural component, they span from 8-bit processors to 32 and 64-bit full-blown solutions. When looking at each element, is this the same old embedded development paradigm? What are the challenges faced when developing a sensor interface, for example, or an IoT device or a gateway? Michael.
Hi, thanks. I think it's a similar paradigm, but it's gotten a lot more complex. There's more components you have to really think about when you're bringing an IoT solution to market. You've got to go end-to-end, so from the connectivity and the components you're going to use all the way to the apps and integration you're going to have on the back end to get the maximum value. And at the same time, everything needs to move faster. You got to get to market more quickly. You got to have a high-quality product the first time, the ability to iterate that and improve it very quickly as well. And, adopting IoT technologies and platforms help you do that more consistently, all the way from connectivity to that back-end integration, which is key, without having to have a huge development team. So you can help contain the size and also, the expertise that you have to have. So instead of having embedded developer and a Java expert and a database management guy and a person who can keep the lights on with the server, you can get all that in one or two people instead of a broader team of 5 or 10.
Okay, interesting. Mark.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the issue here is that it's a system addition. I think as you mentioned, it can be considered a mashup of systems, but the key is what you're really doing is you're changing the system. So embedded designers utilize special techniques, right? So they have very focused functionality. They're looking to use efficient use of the resources that they've got to create a product that's for a specific functionality. So companies optimize their tools for these needs, right? When you're talking about IoT and cloud, this is a system effect. It's going to affect your cost. It's going to affect security. You're adding new technologies, right? Not only in the sensor or the item that you're adding, which if it's a sensor, you know, that can be integrated easily into your overall product. But when you're talking about IoT, it's not just that sensor, but there's other technologies in terms of connectivity. And, you know, these considerations have to be taken because they can really disrupt the overall system and that focused efficiency that the company was originally looking for.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Stan, your perspective.
Hi, yeah, I think that the, you know, first of all, Gartner said the smart machine era will be the most disruptive in the history of IT. I think that's really true. It's going to change an amazing number of industries, an amazing number of applications. We focus on the industrial end of things, not the consumer end of things. It's got a very different set of requirements for large system integration and reliability and legacy system integration. The Industrial Internet Consortium, the ISC that I'm on the steering committee, is, you know, a huge organization now. I think it's the largest of the alphabet soup of IoT consortia. It's 220-something companies. And, you know, we work on things there. We're actually lead committees on connectivity and data management and security and, you know, architectural integration and safety and, you know, lots of test beds, especially industry-focused test beds like microgrid test bed. But anyhow, in the industrial end of things, it's really it's a systems problem. It's not about processors and servers and operating systems and individual developers. It's about the data. Systems are all really all about data. We have a technology that's, you know, data-centric connectivity. Data centricity is very new in the industrial internet. It's really not about fog and cloud and edge. We think of it all as mist. Really, can you pull all these systems together? Some of the concepts are fundamentally new to embedded types. You know, what's really most important to look at new kinds of technologies, if you're building a system that really needs to be reliable, I mean, if it fails for a few minutes or a few milliseconds, it's going to have serious consequences, which means you need redundancy. If you just ever say the words millisecond or microseconds, or if you have multiple teams working on multiple programs that need to be able to integrate with each other, or if you have just too much data to send everything to everyone, you really should be looking at a data-centric way of controlling things. It's like a moving database and a very different way of looking at the world. So I think it's actually quite different than the old embedded development paradigm for many reasons.
Okay, great. Walt.
I would agree. I think it is different than the old embedded development paradigm for many of the reasons that we've mentioned. IoT is complex. It's dynamic. You have to consider the end-to-end impacts of any changes that you make. IoT requires quicker time to market, quicker validation of concepts. So you're kind of the traditional embedded development cycle is too long, too slow. You have to make some changes for that. And IoT means data consumers and data producers have to be integrated without creating a lot of dependencies and roadblocks and walls in between. This changes the way that our solutions are developed. And like if you consider kind of the use case of the IoT gateway, right, there's fragmentation issues, challenges that you have. How do you look at all the different protocols, Zigbee, Z-Wave, Bluetooth? That's just on the sensor side. There's many more. Then you talk about the northbound side where you're talking up to the cloud. Is it MQTT? Is it lightweight M2M? You know, that's a big challenge for developers looking at that. There's complexity. You've got security, reliability, network management, application lifecycle management. How do you upgrade these systems? How do you change for bugs? How do you add new features? How do you change the data that you want to filter and send up? And then there's lock-in. If you're a software developer, are you locked into the hardware? Are you locked into particular sensors? Do you get locked into particular protocols? or even do you get locked into a particular vertical? You might, your application may actually fit across verticals, and you don't really want to be locked in. So the paradigm needs to change. We need to get large developers, communities of developers together, not isolated narrow groups. And I think you do this by having some modular, dynamic, manageable, multi-platform solutions based on open standards, driven by open source.
Okay, great. Thanks, Walt. Brian.
Yeah, and much like many of the speakers that have already said, in a nutshell, yes, it is different. We believe it's actually going to be more like the Internet of APIs rather than the Internet of Things as such. The success of web technology over the last 20 years has shown like their power, flexibility, allows features and functionality to proliferate and be brought to market very, very quickly. And building on flexible and open APIs, we can construct things that are, much greater than the sum of their parts. Many industry watchers, including, say, IDC and InfoWorld, have said that, the APIs are absolutely crucial for IoT, and they've gone as far as to say that, the market size is zero without them. So, this will be, for existing developers, this will be can be brand new ground with new challenges for both, the tool sets, techniques, and even the devices themselves. So no longer will we have embedded devices, simply reacting to button presses or lighting up LEDs or LCDs on front panel displays. No longer will they just be sending data over arcane industrial protocols to domain-specific equipment, but they'll be connected to a fabric that includes the Internet itself and be both producing and consuming data and control information over web technology APIs. So devices and their intended infrastructure will need to scale to large numbers of instances while allowing access and control only to those people who are really meant to get access to it. So while ever more kind of powerful devices continue to emerge, we also believe that resource-constrained devices will still be the most ubiquitous and kind of naturally capable of, least naturally capable of taking part in kind of this future. So they need special attention for the developer if the ecosystem is to advance. So that's the kind of our core goal here at Golgi, to make it easy and quick for device and developers to get kind of a first-class seat at this web API table that I've kind of spoken of, and allow the embedded developer to kind of focus on their core competencies. And that's kind of crucial. As many of the speakers have said, there's a lot of different technologies being brought to bear here. People aren't going to be experts on every single one of them, so we need to make it, we need to incorporate as many constituencies of developers, hopefully that already exist, so that we can, advance at pace to this, bright IoT future that we keep on getting told about.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a lot of interesting points being made there for the development paradigm, cross-discipline, optimizing approach that deals with end-to-end, the data centricity of IoT, which is pretty unique property of that, modular dynamic solutions that consider end-to-end end-to-end IoT applications, and then APIs as well, APIs being crucial for all this to kind of hang together and interoperate. Let's switch to the topic two here. That has to do with correctness, security, and data access. Let's talk about what new and emerging strategies for ensuring correctness exist at the embedded device or gateway or the end-to-end application even. Not only the correctness and the development and the time-to-market aspects, but there's a security paradigm that must be considered. So, are there ways we can identify security threats? What kinds of tools and capabilities allow for that? The data centricity, there's data flowing within the IoT application, and it varies from just statistics and device operation to user data, and that user data can be comprised of non-critical, sensitive, or sensitive information. So let's talk about what kind of tools and techniques exist to kind of provide these levels of data flow, security, time-to-market acceleration, and new-age tools that deal with these kinds of things. Mark?
Yeah, so a lot of this, the good side of this is they're not necessarily new. They are emerging strategies for embedded designs because, as we mentioned earlier, embedded designs are, they're focused. They've got this functionality, and then they're locked down. But when you're getting into IoT, you're talking about opening that up. You're talking about sharing data with other sources. And so there's new things that need to be done. The correctness, you know, there's, again, that was mentioned, using open standards where possible, documentation of your system, which includes APIs. These are all important. The detail correctness is dependent on your need, what's being done. Almost universally, though, it includes compatibility with the connectivity protocol you select, right? You're going to have some kind of connectivity. You need that to work with whatever the end user is going to be doing. If that's Wi-Fi, it could be a number of other protocols if a gateway is used. So here, you know, selecting market leaders in terms of that radio or that RF technology, ones that are used in the access points and used in the connection ecosystem that your product is going to be playing in, that's one methodology. That's key, right? It's another thing to notice, though, or to note is RF itself is a whole new ball game, right? There's knowledgeable requirements for the design of this, both on the module itself but also on the product, because the operational behavior varies. It's not your usual closed box where you push a button and you expect something to happen. It can vary depending on the environmental conditions. Security that was brought up, here, you know, it is known how to harden networks for enterprise grade, for financial, for military, for medical. This isn't something that's brand new that every manufacturer has to determine. So it's not a question of the increased risk footprint, but one of what's the best of breed methods that are already available for AAA security that need to be applied depending on the grade of security that's required on the product. Now, it's also important that there's always minimum needs, right? It doesn't matter if it's a sprinkler that's on your network. If that unit is on an openly shared resource, then it can be a security threat. So it's key to use the AAA security whenever you're doing an IoT-type connectivity product, right? So the platform that you're using has to address security end-to-end, right? That's from the device to the cloud to the app, and then you can lock it down. Privacy is another concern, right? So privacy is separate from security. It's who owns the data, and ensuring that, you know, the end user can control the privacy that you know, to give the rights that they want for the use of their product.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mark. Stan? Stan, you might be on mute.
Hi, sorry about that. Just like systems in general, I think, you know, it's all about data flow. It's a systems problem. We're compliant with a standard called DDS, Data Distribution Service. It's really all about controlling data flow in general, how fast the data is coming, how reliable it's coming, are you actually going to get the data, how do you know when your remote producers of information are alive or not alive, and also controlling security. It's, you know, security in general is a multi-layer problem. I think it's absolutely critical to control the data flow itself. Perimeter security, which I like to call eggshell security, isn't enough. Locking down pipes, layer 2 and layer 3 security, really isn't natural for these kind of systems, because in the industrial Internet of Things especially, you're deep down in the design. You're connecting things all over your plant or all over the road or all inside your car or inside the hospital, and it doesn't work to try and lock down connections between devices. You're really trying to do an application level understanding. So in a medical example, for instance, I want to control which care team sees my information. And I may move, I may switch which devices I'm connected to, I may move around the hospital. 61% of patients move every day in a hospital. There's rules like HIPAA around security and privacy. You're going from an emergency system in an ambulance or in a burning building or in the ambulance, in the hospital, in the home, and you know, these kinds of systems are very hard to track what's connecting to what. It's not hard to track what data flow is going between different points. So it's really all about flow across the enterprise and mobile. In enterprise and mobile, you know, normal applications and in a lot of consumer Internet of Things applications, the flow is really from a single device to a server somewhere, perhaps in the cloud. It's just not the same when you're building a full system in the industrial enterprise. The flow is between applications and between applications and devices. So if you want to be secure, I think you need to have security really be part of the architecture. My metric for security is part of your architecture. If you can take a system that you didn't design security in and implement security without writing any code, that means you actually have an architecture that can support the level of security you need. It shouldn't be a whole lot of code and hacks on top of what you're doing to do that. And you know, to do that, you have to have automated provisioning. If your architecture, for instance, supports reliable multicast, you better have secure, reliable multicast. If your architecture supports connecting and moving connections around in dynamic redundancy, your security better traverse that redundancy. If your architecture supports routing different networks, the security domains have to cleanly route across those networks. All of those things have been worked on for a long time by the DDS standard. It's a real interoperable standard. There's multiple vendors supporting it. It's a very, very, very vetted design by lots of security experts. Our product has had multiple years of multiple red team testing against it. It's been, you know, very well tested. I think you need to go and find something like that to become the fundamental architecture of security.
Okay, great. Thanks, Stan. Walt.
Like Stan and Mark, I think our goals are similar, right? We're talking, we want to maintain customer trust, confidence, ensuring all this integrity, availability, and confidentiality of customer data. And it is an end-to-end solution, right? And that complicates the security issue of finding what's the right, or as Mark said, the best of breed type of security for each individual component. These solutions have a wide range of components and points of failure that are kind of very different when you're taking a look at them. Sensors at the edge, small devices, what are you doing with those versus the gateway versus the cloud versus the network itself, whether that's layer two, what network protocols you're using. So you have to kind of look at the entire system holistically, but address the security at each potential point of failure uniquely for that point of failure. You'll have some common principles and foundations, but the specifics may vary. For example, like if you're looking at some, you know, some example security risks, like a man in the middle, a security risk where you're hacking the network. From an IT, general internet perspective, been a lot of studies. We kind of know what to do for an IP network, how to do ways for man's in the middle. But what about for some of these new sensor to gateway networks, whether it's Zigbee, Z-Wave, proprietary RF, like Mark was talking about? What are people doing there at that level? You know, that adds some new complications for how you handle that. There's also, now with IoT, a lot of these devices aren't sitting in a protected data center. They're out where people can actually have access to them and touch them. So you've got to consider things like physical device tampering. You know, people can hack in. So factory resets. Does your device boot securely? Do you have tamper-resistant key stores on your device so that people can't just hack in and get your default key stores? What does that look like? Then securing your ports, other general access. Can you determine if the device has been hacked? There's also software tampering, right? You're booting a device. Think of doing a rooting a device like you would an Android or an iPhone. If people can hack an iPhone, they could root your device that you have out in the field. So how do you secure against that? How do you do digital signing of all your software to make sure that what you boot up and run is actually what you meant to run? So while there's an end-to-end and there's some general principles that we can apply to all of it, I think you really have to consider each point of failure and what's the, as using Mark's term, the best of breed solution for that particular point of failure in the IoT ecosystem.
Right. Okay, interesting. Thanks, Walt. Brian.
Okay, yeah, the security of IoT systems is extremely important, and it's quite a broad topic, kind of, as the title acknowledges. Not only do we need to make sure our devices are being controlled with and interacted with by the appropriate actors, but we also need to make sure that data's not being observed or tampered with as it traverses kind of the myriad of systems that we've already kind of said are going to make up the IoT ecosystem. I mean, there are many challenges to achieving these, and while many of the more powerful IoT devices can leverage and should indeed leverage kind of the existing state-of-the-art techniques that have been used kind of in the internet at large now and are essentially quite battle-hardened and under full scrutiny, Many of these strategies just aren't possible in resource-constrained devices. Now, there's a kind of an ongoing hypothesis that resource-constrained devices are going to basically go away as Moore's law accelerates us to a kind of an ever more powerful future. We don't necessarily believe that. We think that Moore's law will actually just make the resource-constrained devices cheaper and more power efficient, and they will open up new deployment scenarios for them. So they have to be addressed. There are some for resource-constrained devices. There are some kind of emerging patterns and strategies that are coming up, including hardware crypto that can help them out, and also embedded specific libraries for some of the crypto technology that is currently available. It also bears talking about that it's while crypto is important and everybody would say yes, just dial it straight up to 11. You know, not everything needs the full level of crypto that can be available. And it's interesting to observe the way that kind of public API companies address this on the internet. They play a kind of a balancing act day in, day out of security versus complexity. If they make their service more secure, and increase the complexity for the user, they dissuade potential customers from using it. And in the end, like kind of so many choices in life, it's still not black and white. It's a blend of concerns should be considered, and then the appropriate level of security should be employed. It's easy to say in the extreme cases, financial and health information should absolutely be afforded as much security as possible. But should we really apply that level of security to the humidity level in my basement? Possibly not. So there isn't really a one size fits all. Depending on the capability of the device being used, the gamut of security options available varies accordingly. And for resource constrained devices, specialized hardware and software is available to help us out there. And also we have to you should bear in mind the use case. Don't overcomplicate it. If you don't have to. Just navigate these waters. If we do that properly, useful products can be realized and gotten to market with the appropriate level of security and kind of in a timely fashion.
Makes sense. Thanks, Brian. Michael?
I mean, at this point, with so much shared, I don't have a ton to add except to acknowledge that I think security is a very broad topic. To agree with the fact that it's not a cookie cutter approach, right? Everybody has to take a look at what they're doing and tighten up where they need to tighten up. Ways I think you can be more confident about your security are to choose proven solutions, whether they be open source or commercial, things where there's a demonstrated success, references and that kind of thing. But you can also take actions on your own that tighten up your approach. What data do you really need? What should be left on the site? What should be taken back up to the server? Not everything needs to be taken to the server to implement a successful IoT initiative. So think about those pieces of data you really need or want. On the other hand, it is a balancing act. You don't want to find yourself without instrumented data that you need down the road. But especially when it comes to things like healthcare, financial, pharmaceutical, you can be very effective with certain key pieces of data that aren't necessarily sensitive as far as IP or security as much as they are just informational, like CPU utilization, cycle counts, and those kinds of things. And then having some easy back-end integration for your solution allows you to take that information and validate it more fully, right? So is the information coming off the system consistent with what I think it should be based on my sales records or, other information I have at my fingertips through my back-end systems? I think you need to take a look early on at your security needs and go through the full end-to-end solution spectrum and be confident that the network you've chosen is going to provide the security you need that the the hardware is hardened. And then look at other things that aren't necessarily IoT related either, like physical access to the site. I still think there's a bigger threat for security in those kinds of areas than there are, with actually hacking and hijacking, the data in transit or at rest. So those are things not to forget about either.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot, Michael. Yeah, lots of good things brought up there in terms of looking at the security from a holistic approach, but addressing potential failures at each node end, in general, for correctness and testing as well. So before we get to our Q&A, we do have some good questions coming in. We encourage the audience to keep asking those questions. We are we'll be answering them after the topic three here. So we're switching gears now to real-world examples and strategies that kind of roll up the first two topics into some actual applications. So what are some real-world examples of utilizing these tools and techniques to accelerate development in IoT? What kinds of descriptions for IoT systems for specific industry segments, and what kind of challenges and solutions might have been come across for you folks, and any unique or useful tools you used to make your development faster, but you're still providing resilient, reliable IoT solutions? Let's start with Stan.
Hi. So big topic for 3 minutes. I mean, the really fun thing about the IoT is the broad reach. We're in hundreds of applications. I think we're well over 900 applications out there now. They range across a lot of industries. Actually, GE Healthcare, maybe I'll put a plug in for tomorrow. The chief engineer of GE Healthcare LCS Systems is going to do sort of an inside scoop on how they're implementing stuff, obviously using with ours. Technology, you can go to rti.com and scroll down a bit, and you'll see there the GE Healthcare webinar. I'm actually a little worried we're going to overwhelm the servers. I think we get more, we may have to cut people off. But, also emergency systems. We have ambulance providers, physio control that makes little AEDs and devices you carry into a burning building, a robotic surgery in the medical space. It's just a whole array of areas there. In the power world, the biggest thing we're working on is the microgrid architecture, which is a new way to develop a smart grid that can handle solar energy and wind power and battery storage out in the field much better. But also much larger systems like Siemens wind power turbines and huge SCADA systems like the Grand Coulee Dam. We also do a lot of process control, and NASA's KSC launch control system is a big SCADA system, air traffic control in China and Europe, Canada soon, the transportation industry is really changing a lot. Autonomy, our RTI's backgrounds in autonomy, mostly autonomous air vehicles. Lately, we've been taking that technology into autonomous cars. Autonomous car industry is just taking off. We have lots of customers there, partially because we have a safety certified version, which really helps a lot. Autonomous car problem is very similar, actually, to some of the other autonomy issues we've been dealing with for years. So, as a real example, before I run out of time here, in a hospital, you'd have a medical equipment manufacturer building many types of devices that have to cooperate in real time to monitor and control care of thousands of patients. They have fast feedback loops, shared video streams, a lot of video in surgical theaters and in hospitals in general now, along with, waveform processing and passing around. It has to go to the medical record, it has to be analyzed. It's a very important thing to do, and you sort of have a global data availability makes that a much easier thing to do, especially if it's, real-time, reliable, redundant, secure, all those kinds of things really help you build systems.
Okay, great. Thanks, Stan. Walt?
Thanks. I think the way that you accelerate this deployment is to provide these modular building blocks that provide you a way to kind of quickly and cheaply test out your concept and then move that solution to a commercially deployable systems. And an example is how Eurotech used Eclipse Cura and our ESF to build a customer solution for a cold chain application. They were looking at monitoring perishable foods, perishables in a truck Say you wanted to measure the temperature, the humidity, things like that in the back and stuff about the truck. Is the door open, closed, lights, things like that. And they had already looked at some sensors from a company called Monit, and they wanted proof points that all this would work before they committed to the full solution. So what we did is, using Eclipse Open Source Cure, we downloaded that to a Raspberry Pi, which provided us kind of all the platform components that we needed, gave us an MQTT client up to the cloud, USB abstraction, remote management, a local GUI for management, a lot of other services that come with Cura. We created an open sandbox on the Eurotech Everywhere cloud to collect the MQTT data. And then we took the Monit USB sensor that we're talking to the RF sensors, put that in, started doing the integration. And to be honest with you, within a couple of days, we had a pilot with a couple of the sensors working and talking. I think it was the temperature sensor and the humidity sensor. Most of that was, doing the bit-byte decoding from the USB part. What that did is that gave a working system. Customer was able to kind of look at it, iterate through it, see what they liked and didn't like and how we could expand that. So after a few more iterations, we finally had what would look like the final development. And then we were able to move that without changing the code over to commercially deployable hardware. It was ruggedized gateway that was specifically built for transportation, like trucks, running on top of ESF, which is Eurotech's kind of commercialized, supported Cura with some security enhancements, and then moved their cloud instance over to a production instance. And I think, developers can use this same sort of process of leveraging open source and readily available open hardware like a Pi, an Edison, a BeagleBoard to build out their pilots and then move over to the commercial versions and the commercialized supported versions of those when they finally go to production, and that greatly speeds up the deployment of these IoT solutions.
Great. Thanks, Walt. Brian.
I'm actually going to talk about quite a specific project we were involved in here at Golgi. There was a very small company came to us, which they had an existing device, which is a room temperature sensor, and it was connected via serial line to a dedicated server, and it would monitor. It was used for monitoring server rooms and commercial refrigeration systems, and the control unit gathered the data that the server, the dedicated server, was connected to. Over the serial lines, presented it on premises on the local LAN, and could send emails to support personnel when things went out of range, and also SMSs via a cellular module that was attached to it. And what the team wanted to do is they basically wanted to remove as much hardware from that as possible, and get it down to just the device connected via Wi-Fi, configured by a mobile application, but keep all the existing functionality of both recording the data and being able to notify the support personnel when things went wrong. The device itself was, as I've, in my segments here, been talking about a resource-constrained device. It was a Cortex-M3, it had 16K of RAM and 48K of flash, so something more akin to an early 80s microcomputer than some of the devices we have available today. And what they did was they put on a low-power Wi-Fi module on the existing serial port there, and that's how they got their IP connectivity. So, from the security point of view, what they used was they put the Wi-Fi module at startup into soft AP mode to exchange some keys, and that allowed them to use a kind of a low overhead symmetric key encryption between the mobile application and the embedded device. So that's how they got that ball rolling. The device itself recorded its temperature over Wi-Fi out to the cloud, storing it in a third-party service that they used from there. And the devices themselves could also send email and send SMS using SendGrid for email and Twilio for SMS. So the project was actually really interesting for us to see a kind of an existing, almost traditional IoT system being morphed into something that's kind of, you know, much more like what we see the kind of the future of IoT, leveraging taking an ecosystem approach, leveraging as many existing technologies that exist out there as possible, yet reducing the actual footprint of the device itself. It was a nice trade-off. Well, on the security side of things, as I mentioned earlier on, you know, to make that not too complex, using a soft AP mode if possible, that makes that nice. But other ones we have seen people use are things like, you know, using either hard-coded serial numbers on the device or QR codes to get that initial key exchange thing going. So yeah, it was a really interesting project to be involved in. Really educational to see the company, who are what we would call traditional embedded developers, embracing this kind of new IoT ecosystem, and being really rewarded with that effort.
Okay, great. Thanks, Brian. Michael.
Yeah, hi. When it comes to this kind of topic of real world examples, I mean, for me, it's the hard part is choosing one. We've been in business quite a while. We have lots of cool examples. We're talking to all kinds of different companies, all the way from super complex medical equipment to chainsaws. And of course, you know, the requirements across that broad spectrum are very different. The resource slide we actually have for ThingWorx today does go to a case study, and our website has a lot of other ones too. So beyond, you know, what I'm going to talk about now, if you want to get a broader sense for, you know, what's possible, what's been done, I invite everybody to go check out those resources. The one I'm having in mind, I just think it's such a neat story and something that we all can experience probably part of our life is walking through the grocery store. And when you go into the grocery store down here in Florida, we have Publix, there's scales in the deli department. And those scales, believe it or not, are IoT devices. They're connected. They're reporting the prices that they are printing, and all that information is being used to make sure that, one of the problems in the meat department sometimes is if the prices don't get updated at the scales, you're giving away a lot of value, right? Because you're printing off a price sticker there at the scale that doesn't meet the actual current requirement for the price. Then you go to checkout, right, and you want to go through one of the checkout kiosks. It's a self-help kiosk, right? So you scan your products and you put them in the... There's a lot of ways that those can go wrong. We have software running on those that help the manufacturer of that device keep it up and online so that when you get there to go through your checkout, it's not a frustrating process for you. And then even to ancillary experiences like we used to do Blockbuster, they're not around anymore. But when we did have Blockbuster kiosks, this is a good example. We had those connected, and so if there was a jam in the feed mechanism, there was a way for that company to log in, view through a camera what was going on inside of that machine, and actually clear the jam, the physical jam, remotely. So there's a tremendous amount of value, and as you look around, you're going to see IoT just emerge everywhere, from your hot water heater to your refrigerator to your washing machine, and there's things that weren't feasible to even think about 3 to 5 years ago that now, thanks to new technology, reduction in costs, new network plans to the cellular providers, all that stuff is really feasible. So I would say when you're thinking about, can my device be connected to IoT, the answer is definitely yes. And then if you're an SI or other company like that, and you want to say what could be connected, I'd say anything. And if you want to get a really good sense for what could be, exploring these resources we're going to have at the end of the call today, I think that's a great starting point.
Okay, great. Thanks, Michael. Mark?
Yeah, let me address this with OEMs in general, and then I'll mention one specifically as well. In that segment, that's an industry segment that has fully embraced embedded design. And the value for this segment in IoT is to really garner data about the operation of their products and their customers' experience of the product once it's in the field, because this information hasn't been available in real time before, right? And selecting an IoT platform that's resilient and then reliable enough to collect the data and then efficiently affect changes to the product once you have that data and have analyzed it, that's paramount to building brand strength and leadership, right? So what's required is a platform that addresses the issues that we've all been talking about, through this webinar. So for leading brand manufacturers, what this means is that it's a battle. It's a battle between margin and having last year's tech for their brand, right? So startups can point the way, but we shouldn't be surprised that leading brand companies have decades of domain expertise, right? And IoT provides a mechanism for them to bring the strength to market in new ways. So you'll see this with door locks. You're going to see this with lighting. You're going to see this with appliances, all kinds of products. So the Kidde Remote Link, that's an example of a company that's a leader in smoke and fire safety. And they're applying their in-house knowledge to create a game-changing product, right? And it's in response to a changing market of connected smoke alarms. And they did this without building their own whole, you know, internal IoT, IT department. But they leveraged their core strengths, their knowledge, and they outsourced their context needs, right? So OEMs have this in-house core strength in best applying their technology to their brand. To their product at hand, right? So they're very fluent in embedded design and serial ports, MCUs, you know, memory use, industrial design. They understand the development environments that they have settled on for their own optimizations. So where ALIS core strength comes is to provide the IoT context for these world-leading OEMs, right? And in the example above, this was done by providing a wireless connection as a serial to cloud module for them. Right, not a raw agent that needed to be integrated with a new SDK. You know, they didn't have to worry about MQTT, co-op, or other protocol comparison, right, because what that becomes is a technical competition for efficiency that leads to pricing, right? So this is addressed by the platform and doesn't need to be addressed by the OEM. The cloud services provided by configuration and management dashboards, you know, rather than yet another SDK for the OEM to learn. So, and then finally, app support is provided via a framework that's skinnable, right, and brandable without the need for ground-up Android or iOS development. So by using these facilities that were available in this platform, right, this and other OEMs really get to their time to market, and then they can lay claim to their brand strength, which is really that promise of the IoT.
Great. Thanks a bunch. We are now to the Q&A. Start with a question for Walt. Good question about what types of processor cores and capabilities do we need in our silicon? Do we need powerful ones? Do we need cores that consume very little power? And then is power a major issue in IoT we need to be worried about?
Yeah, that's a good question, Kurt. And now, there's a certain sense where the amount of cores and what you need depend on where you are in this end-to-end infrastructure. At the gateway and the sensor devices, you know, cores are becoming pretty cheap for the power that you get. $35 for a quad-core ARM Raspberry Pi is pretty cheap. As you go down to the sensors, you can get smaller than that. So there's a certain sense where that has become less important. Something like a Cura can run on just about any of those devices, so that's nice. The power consumption, though, can be very important when you're looking at that. Gateways are often battery backed up. Sometimes they're not connected to dedicated power sources if they're running on a truck or something like that. So you do have to consider that. And in particular, sensors are very often not connected directly to power, and they become very power sensitive, whether you're using a coin cell battery. And a lot of that, then you have the trade-off of how often do you need the information versus how much battery you want to drain for turning up the radio network. And so there's a little trade-off there, and we've had a fair amount of experience doing that and working through that trade-off.
Okay. Great. Let's see here. So it sounds like a kind of a range of cores and power is an issue that we need to worry about. Brian, let's talk about the APIs. You talked a lot during your discussion about APIs. Are we working towards standardization of interfaces for IoT? Are you aware of things in this arena where standards are emerging?
Yes, there's a lot of work has been done in the past and exists out there. Unfortunately, a lot of it's overlapping, and some of the standards bodies are even, you know, pulling them all into it, which is a bit unfortunate. But in general, kind of the general slant of a lot of what I've been speaking of is really the kind of the lessons that have been learned from the kind of the way web technology APIs have proliferated on the open internet and the benefits and synergies we've gotten from that. So while there are standards available out there and they are indeed being incorporated, more on the kind of the local area side of things, so for device discoverability, capability discoverability, and interactions, what I'm more kind of articulating is the use of web technology APIs, which can be self-describing and you know very extremely flexible, and then used by and leveraged by that huge constituency of web developers that exist out there. So bringing the you know bringing a large constituency of developers to bear on the IoT ecosystem to basically bootstrap it with a big developer base.
I see. Okay, Stan, do you have any thoughts on the APIs?
Yeah. I mean the standardization of the interfaces for the IoT is really. RTI invests very heavily in that. In fact, we're in 15 different consortia doing that, all the way from protocols to you know, large systems like with the IIC. The IIC has a very explicit goal to build standards for the industrial Internet of Things that goes from sensor to cloud, interoperates between vendors and spans industries. But we're also in industry-focused consortia in medical, in vehicles, in power, in avionics, and consumer electronics and even broadcast television, so you know, there's many different levels of standardization and architectures. I actually think the IIC's core connectivity structure is sort of the state of the art there. You can't really specify a single way to put things together, but you can specify a few of them with very crisply defined gateways between them and gateways to other things as well. There actually will be standard recommendations in the next version that's going to be out soon. But even with, I love the way the question was posed because standardization of interfaces, because it's not just about interfaces to standards, it's also about standardization of your interfaces. Even within your design, you need to manage your interfaces. You know, DDS is the standard that we're doing, but it really is all about managing interfaces. The interface is the data. DDS manages that interface directly. It communicates that interface. It evolves that interface. It controls access to that interface. It controls flow and flow rates and flow availability through the interfaces. I mean, it really is something that I'm encouraging people to go learn about. It's pretty new in the industrial Internet, very different from what's out there in enterprise Internets.
Okay, great. Mark, there was a question about is network connectivity outside the scope of IoT? In some customer applications, the customer's you know, IT infrastructure might decide the connectivity or dictate what connectivity is. And so it's an interesting question. That how do you layer the IoT, the scope of IoT, given you know that kind of environment where maybe the customer you know dictates or has requirements on network connectivity, yet you want the application to work in a general purpose way?
Yeah, this is actually a good question, and it goes back to our topic one, where it is very much a system view, right? The IoT is a system implication to an embedded design. And the the RF infrastructure or the network infrastructure is part of that system. And a manufacturer or somebody looking to field it must consider that, right? So a case in point may be, you know, you create a product where you have, you know, it's searching for an open Wi-Fi network and it gives the user a page to log in. Now, if that product gets used in an enterprise environment, you know, and there's a radio server that has to go through and this doesn't work, right, then that's a problem, and the problem is that these problems become support calls that come in, and those support calls can bring down the margin that's available in a product. So this has to be considered, and if that's not an operating environment that the product's intended to, then it must be documented so that the people who are buying it, you know, are not surprised and put these support tickets in.
Okay, great, thanks. Michael, there's a good question about how important things like FPGAs are in the market or GPUs, or is this just multiprocessor, multi-core processors that we're dealing with? in terms of sensor data on a microprocessor, that's one thing with GPIOs or what have you. But in terms of the information access and processing end to end, are these other technologies important or used?
I think you're going to find basically every technology brought to bear. I was listening to the standards question with interest. You got to be ready to accept any kind of data from any source or any system if it has value to the solution. So all those kinds of sensors, SCADA systems, factory automation systems, even order processing systems, SFDC, customer support systems, dispatching systems, all those things need to be data sources you're considering when you're putting together an IoT project. I think we put the blinders on sometimes and say, well, that data is interesting, but it's not available or useful to me. But it can be, and one data point can be very powerful. As an example, a cycle count off of a printer can be used by service to automate preventative maintenance. It can be used by engineering to engineer out the cost of the next generation if they see that, they put a 10,000 cycle drum in and 5,000 is the average cycle use before replacement. It can be used by marketing. It can be used by sales. If they see a heavily used device, they can go back in and try and sell a second unit. So don't discount any information you have available to you as being part of your IoT solution is what I'd say.
Okay, great. There's a great question. I want to start with Stan, but I think other panelists will be wanting to chime in here. Do we need a new operating system for IoT, one that's distributed, one that's scalable across the components, one that provides direct access to the device driver, without the gateway or the device server, and capable of data dissemination? So we're talking about something where maybe the OS has calls in it to, grab data off of any of these endpoints through the application. Do we need another operating system, or do we have the capabilities we need today to be able to address IoT effectively, Stan?
Yeah, I think it's a new way of thinking that's really needed. It's really not about an operating system. Today's systems are based on, what chip is it running, what operating system is it running. Tomorrow's systems are really going to be systems. They'll run on lots of operations. We support 80 platforms, many, many operating systems and languages and, different kinds of chip architectures. You sort of can't think about that way when it's a big system. It's you can actually think of DDS is sort of a distributed operating system, but you sort of need to redefine what an operating system is. I firmly believe that the industrial Internet of Things is really all about data, pervasive data flow, pervasive data availability is critically new to this world, and it really isn't about an operating system, or the classic definition of operating system is something that runs applications and schedules the use of the CPU and controls, the activities of a CPU, really. I actually think we need a data system, not an operating system. It's a very different thought, a different way of thinking about the world with virtual global data availability. Things are better. And just for the record, we've lost connectivity. I don't know if anybody can hear me or not there anymore.
No, I think we can hear you. The Q&A is being way overloaded, so the Q&A kind of is quite slow.
Okay.
All right. Brian, you talked a lot about APIs. Is there just a level of middleware that we need naturally on an OS? Or?
Well, I think Sam made a good point. The focus has moved on a little bit. It's kind of like asking, do we need a new OS for the internet? We've moved up the chain. It is about data, moving data around, making sure that data is coming from where we think it's coming from, going to where we think it's going to, and easily consumable. Yes, there may be OSs may come and go that are better or worse at doing that. But also, again, to get back to my own particular hobby horse, the resource-constrained devices, if there is a wonderkind new OS available, won't be able to run it anytime soon.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. Walt, do you have any thoughts on that in terms of, you mentioned, you know, a holistic approach, but in a specific point of failure things, can a IoT OS help with that? Or
Well, yeah, I mean, an IoT OS can certainly, you know, help with some of the paradigms that we've been talking about today. But there's really, where there seems to be quite a bit of innovation is on the kind of the deployment side of things necessarily, rather than so the helping developers, helping the kind of the system maintainers more than necessarily addressing the actual IoT problem itself. So things like software, software lifecycle management, remote updating, that sort of thing. There are a lot of tools which are, you know, blurring the line between what traditionally would have been kind of OS and more kind of DevOps, and that's becoming much more important, certainly in the solutions that we're seeing.
I see.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's the platform level that's moved up above the OS level, that's kind of the abstraction for that, and the right OS will be for the right devices. New ones will come and go, but you need an open platform that as protocols change, the OS changes, and as somebody was talking about the FPGAs, right, and the types of devices that you connect to, we're used to some now, they're going to change. It's the open platform that you need that gives you the ability to adapt to all these changes, where I think the IoT space has kind of moved to.
Yeah, I agree with that, too.
Okay, great. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of the hour here. I want to thank Mark, Walt, Brian, Stan, Michael for sharing your expertise in IoT. We at Open Systems Media, AILA, Eurotech, Golgi, RTI, ThingWorks, want to thank you, the audience, for contributing excellent questions remotely. Unfortunately, we did not get to all of them, but, you know, obviously you can reach out to these companies and get personal access to their expertise. This panel eCast will be posted online at the URL that will hopefully be showing up on your screen soon. Your questions and attendance has been great with this. Note that an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. Want to thank you all for your time today, and have a great day.